This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachel. For more than 100 years, the dominant image of an African-American cook was that of Aunt Jemima. Her face appeared on pancake boxes and syrup bottles all over the country, and it carried a message that implied African-American cooks were uneducated, poor, and always working at the direction of white women. But culinary journalist Toni Tipton Martin's new cookbooks that she had in her collection told a different story, one of talented, inventive, and nurturing cooks. So she began compiling them into a book. The result is The Jemima Code, and it won a James Beard Award in 2015. An exhibit about her scholarship is on view at Duke University's Center for Documentary Studies. It includes the first known photographs of African-American cooks. Toni Tipton Martin will give an artist talk and a book signing at the Center for Documentary Studies tonight. It begins at 6, but right now on this show, Toni Tipton Martin, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks so much, Frank. It's good to be with you.
Give us a little bit of the backstory and sort of how you came to think about this question of the Jemima Code, as you call it.
Well, you know, I realized that I had several experiences growing up that formed the basis for this idea of there being a code, encoded messaging about African-American women. I wasn't always aware exactly what it was that was stirring my emotions. There were things like the Tom and Jerry cartoon, where you were only able to see the bottom legs of this heavyset cook, and the abuse that she took at the hands of the cartoon characters. There were images from film, like Imitation of Life, right? And this woman whose pancake making is so excellent that she's able to make an entire career for the woman that she works for. So I was never, as a youngster, I wasn't sure what was going on with me, but I was storing up those emotions. And it wasn't until I became a reporter for the LA Times that I realized the significance of that emotional trauma when I didn't find my relatives in cookbooks that were on our shelves. And as a reporter, I was looking for people to interview, realized that they had all passed on. And it occurred to me that cookbooks might be a resource for that first person interview that I was looking for. So I started collecting them.
And I want to talk more about those and what you found, but let's get a little more sense of the impact of that. Again, because it's so subversive, it works so innocuously but powerfully on our imaginations. I mean, Aunt Jemima, let's stick with her for a moment. This is a character who really comes out of minstrelsy and ends up on the kitchen tables of everybody in America, right?
Yes, that's true. And she, this idea of one woman who can pluck the heartstrings of so many people in so many unique and different ways speaks to actually the effectiveness of the concept, right? And the construct that she's accomplished exactly what she was intended to do, which was initially, of course, to sell more pancake flour. But she's also done something much more subversive, which is extend the practices of segregation to segregating food, to segregating people through food.
Well, how did, now, to tell us about that. How does that happen through the image of Aunt Jemima?
Yeah, sure. So here is this woman who means different things to different people. African Americans read that image. I can't speak for all African Americans, of course. But the messaging that's telegraphed out to us is that we are perpetual slaves in a box, as one scholar has described her, that she symbolizes the fact that we can never be more than these subservient cooks. On the other hand, she messages to white families that sense of nurture and superiority. If you notice, she's always portrayed as a ignorant laborer or as a magician who cooks with a natural instinct. And so she's conveyed to white women, I think even into today's kitchens, that cooking is an act of labor. We even have terminology, slaving in the kitchen. And I think that's at the root of a lot of us being unable to cook now, because this image of slaving is something that we've wanted to move away from.
But as you suggest, it's a complicated image because also it carries with it a kind of warmth and nurturing if you ignore some of the ways in which it keeps Aunt Jemima and, by extension, women and African-American women in a subservient position. I mean, here's an example. Let's listen to this is a very early recorded commercial for Aunt Jemima pancake flour.
Aunt Jemima,
I wish I was on the cotton, oh, thank God, not the cotton of the bay.
Greetings, folks, greetings. This is your old friend, Aunt Jemima.
And pleased as punch with yourself this morning, aren't you, Aunt Jemima?
Of course I am, Mr. Lyon. Maybe you don't know it, but this year is buckwheat time. And I'm here to tell the ladies how they can happify the whole family with rich and mellow, light and fluffy, tempting Aunt Jemima buckwheat.
Buckwheat. I love them.
Sure you does. Everybody do.
There you go. It's a clip from an old commercial for Aunt Jemima buckwheat pancakes. I'm talking to Toni Tipton Martin about her book, The Jemima Code. So what do you hear in that? I mean, it's warm and nurturing, and that series of commercials features her with kind of country wisdom. She was like a little saying that she offers for her audience. So sweet and nurturing on the one hand. She knows her business, right? She knows how to make a pancake.
Well, that's part of why this messaging is so complicated, and the disentanglement of that nurture, separating that from what it means to be competent in the kitchen, right? It is somehow implied that when one cooks with love and with nurture and compassion, that those proficiencies that we associate with a culinary degree are somehow mutually exclusive and that they cannot coexist in this woman. And so the purpose of reviewing the cookbooks was for me to evaluate the legacies that they left in print in an unbiased way. I wanted to be able to read these works with a view of how we would think about these people if they were white.
So tell us more about the cookbooks that you found. It was just the collection itself. What were they?
Sure. So the collection started when I was at the Times. Many years ago. And I picked up a book in a giveaway called The New Orleans Cookbook by Lena Richard. It was from the 1940s. And I realized that New Orleans cooking was not Southern cooking, but I had hoped that somewhere in my future there would be a relevance for this book. And then some years later, John Edgerton, a Southern sage and whom we call the father of Southern food studies. He introduced me to another book from Kentucky, published in 1912. And I was able to start to see a pattern. These were voices that were promoting education and uplift in the community. The more books that I collected, I began to see authors hoping to empower the next generation using food as a tool for economic uplift. The code, the encoded message in those books would certainly be you're a servant, you're perpetuating more servitude, you're creating more service businesses. But what we're able to see in these cookbooks, which begin in 1827 with a house servants directory, and we're able to start to extract proficiencies and values that I took to calling Jemima clues that persist throughout the books.
What are some of those?
So in the first categories in the 19th century, we can see these people as managers with organizational and technical skills. The household managers are instructing the next generation on the daily minutiae of running an elite home, how far the flower basket on the table needs to be from the person seated at the top of the table, how far the tablecloth, how many inches the tablecloth can hang over the edge. And that's easy to discount unless we start to think about these people as uneducated, people who are illiterate and expected to use the tools that they have, their hands, their senses, to make those measurements, right? And so that would imply a great deal of visual intelligence, in my opinion. We're also able to see them through the eyes of entrepreneurship. If we extract off race and the biases of gender and class, then we could look at people who operated vending businesses, who sold goods on the street, people who had oyster houses, bartenders. We can see all of those people through Business 101 skills and start to think about people who understand pricing and inventory and marketing of their product. One of the keys that business people are taught is maintaining eye contact, for example. And these are people who cannot make eye contact with white people walking down the street, and yet they find a way to sell their goods. And so the book goes through 200 years of food history, looking for clues into what other proficiencies and values we see.
You had an experience, too. You talked about working at the L.A. Times. You also worked at the Cleveland Plain Dealer, and you worked with a woman named Vera Beck and had an experience there that, again, sort of showed you how these discrepancies are playing out every day.
Yes. Yeah, so the Cleveland Plain Dealer was one of only a dozen or so newspapers in the late 90s to maintain a test kitchen, where the recipes that run on the paper every week were tested for their validity and taste. And Vera Beck was the person in charge of that activity. Mm. But she was known in the newsroom as just an ordinary cook from Alabama without really any intelligence, only working at the instruction of the staff, who brought no competencies of her own from her past. And that's not the woman that I saw, especially when I compared her to the level of professionalism in the Los Angeles Times test kitchen. And if I wasn't looking at Vera through a racial lens, the two women were performing in the same capacity.
I'm assuming at the L.A. Times,
it was a white woman,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
And she was an educated home economic. She had a degree in home economics.
So you have feature a number of individuals in your book, including our region's own Mama Dip of Chapel Hill's Mama Dip's Kitchen. Tell us about her and how she figures into your book.
Well, as I was describing the categorization of these authors, Mama Dip fits into a space for me, which I hope will be complementary to her, of the country cook. And I don't mean like backwards country. Yeah. I mean the woman who understood farm to table before that was considered a movement. Yeah. But she also helps us understand the cooking of the middle class, or as I've called it, cooking when resources permit. Because her books have many recipes that use convenience food products. And again, there is a code there that in this day and age, we would look disparagingly back over recipes that have cream of mushroom soup or something like that in them. But if we're able to look at that through the Black experience and realize that African Americans didn't always have access to commercial products, to convenience foods, and so we have had to do the harder labor in producing the meal. We couldn't just buy the packaged frozen corn. We actually had to wake up early in the morning. One restaurateur in Louisville explained to me that she has to get up before her restaurant is open just to shuck the corn at 3 in the morning. And so Mama Dip helps us see food prepared with an eye towards freshness and healthfulness, but she also embeds within that the idea that there are economic choices that she makes in her recipes also.
I will just say you cannot make green bean casserole without cream of mushroom soup.
No, you can't. And you do have to take that into perspective for the timing. A lot of us don't make it today, but
maybe that's why I don't make it. Listen, you feature another person in the book, Lena Richards, who had a television show for cooking 2 decades before Julia Child, or almost 2 decades, right?
Yes. And so let me just quickly respond to the green bean casserole to say that the cream of mushroom soup is a labor saver. Right. These are people who would have had to make a white bechamel sauce from scratch, mm-hmm. and the labor of associated with stirring the butter and the flour and making sure that it doesn't scorch. There is a talent associated with that as an art. And so the idea of using a homemade cream of mushroom soup versus something that you could quickly pour out of a can, at that time, I can certainly see the appeal of that. So I just want to make sure that I give Mrs. Council that credit. As for Lena Richard, as I mentioned earlier, that her book is the first book that I started the collection for me. And what's curious about her and what is so compelling about this message of a code in her story is the fact that she published a book in 1939 entitled Lena Richard's New Orleans Cookbook. And she was also on television in New Orleans. She had a cooking show. And the book was produced as a sort of a companion manual to this TV show. And she also operated restaurants in which she, again, tried to bring up the next generation by teaching them about bookkeeping and personnel issues and so on. So James Beard, the father of American cuisine, was enchanted with Lena Richard's work, and he lobbied his publisher to republish her book, which they did a year later in 1940, with a new title. The book became The New Orleans Cookbook by Lena Richard. But what is the most tragic is that she took out, they'd removed her photo. So she had a photo of herself in pearls and a very lovely frontispiece, and that was removed from the book.
We can see lots of photos in your book. Also, there's an exhibit that's associated with your book at the Duke Center for Documentary Studies. Tony Tipton Martin, thank you so much for being on our program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tony Tipton Martin, culinary journalist, author of the James Beard Award-winning book, The Jemima Code, and a traveling exhibit currently on display at Duke Center for Documentary Studies. Tony Tipton Martin's going to be at the center tonight for a reception and an artist talk. We have the information at our website, stateofthings.org. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.